Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Welcome to Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin. Today we're taking a deep dive into the meteoric rise of Chinese tech companies around the world. The most popular content platform in the world originated from China, TikTok. TikTok overtook WhatsApp as the world's most downloaded app back in 2021. Venture capitalists around the world still seeking out the next Pinduoduo or Meituan, scouring Latin America. But China seems to have cracked the code for greatness when it comes to tech. But very often you'll hear the founders of phenomenally successful Chinese tech firms typically credited with courage to venture to the unknown or vision to take their companies to new heights. But can't the same be said of Silicon Valley founders? What is it? What is that X factor that gives Chinese founders and their companies the advantage to becoming multi-billion global enterprises? My guest today is Professor of Strategy at INSEAD. Guo Lichen is author of Seeing the Unseen Behind Chinese Tech Giants Global Venturing as we reverse engineer, we hope, the success and strategies of Chinese tech firms. Good morning, Professor Chen.
Hi, good morning, Michelle.
Great to speak with you. So your book talks about something that the acronym POP wraps around: people, organization, and product and leadership. Tell us about what POP leadership is and what are some examples of the traits that Chinese tech leaders have in common?
Thanks. Thank you. So POP leadership, it's a framework that we use in the book to help our readers to have a quick diagnosis and analyze the business opportunities and challenge, like you said, right? So POP leadership, it's the POP leadership. And the first P represents the products. And so that is the products and services, so the user interface that the company try to engage the customers, try to get the source of the revenue. And the second letter, the O, is the organization, right? So it addresses the fundamental issues such as the decision rights, information communication, resource allocations, and how to keep the organizational agility when company become larger and larger. And then the second P is people. So they are the micro agents of the firms who make things happen. The comment and question is like where to hire, how to motivate the people. And the last one, leadership, you know, this is the most important leaders who set the ambitions and direction for their firms. And part of my research is about leadership effects, and if you try to understand a firm's strategy, and we need to study, it's a strategist. Leader provides a shortcut to comprehend or even forecast what's the next strategic move, right? So like in the book, we have a full analysis, a deep write-up about like what is the POP leaderships and then how that the Chinese leaders use this like POP leaderships to move their organizations to change the world, especially in the consumer tech space. So back to the question about like what are the similarities of the traits of the Chinese tech leaders, right? So I think one of the unique things which I think shares among a group of the Chinese leaders, which is not by those Silicon Valleys, it's with the notable exception of the Jack Ma, I think most of the Chinese leaders tend to be quiet and patient and try to keep the low profiles, although they are thoughtful, they are very determined. I think the determination part is very similar to successful Silicon Valley founders, but the other traits, especially trying to keep low profile and patience, and that part I think is pretty unique to China business and maybe the social environments. The other one, which I think through our interviews, for our research, we find it's very interesting, is like all these, the group of the Chinese leaders are all avid readers of the history, or real or even the fictional ones, such as The Journey to the West. I don't know if you've read these fictional stories before. So they learn leadership, they learn strategy, and then tactics and human nature from this like China's rich history. So that is the part which I think the Chinese leaders are a little bit different from those like Western leaders.
That is fascinating that they're quiet and they're great readers, and that there's certain books that they seem to gravitate to that might explain some of the similarities. I think your book talks about Chinese history, folklore, even Mao's political strategies. Can you share a little bit about how they have shaped the leadership approaches of the leaders that you, the Chinese tech leaders?
Thanks. Yeah. So this is like one of the very interesting findings that we have. It's like during the interview, many successful all the struggle entrepreneurs that we personally know have read the five volumes of a selected work of the Mao Zedong in recent years and try to draw the inspirations and strategies from the leader of the communist revolution. So this is quite interesting for us. It's kind of a little bit surprising, especially in those early days, because we thought they are probably the biggest beneficiary after Mao's societal and economic policy was lifted by, you know, the Mr. Deng Xiaoping, right? But for then, Mao's writing, for this group of the Chinese tech leaders, for then, Mao's writing, it's kind of the contemporary of the arts of the war, right? So this is the ancient text written by Chinese
leaders.
Sun Tzu, yes, exactly. So Sun Tzu wrote this the art of words about like 2,000 years ago, and then they can see that Mao's work is kind of the contemporary version of the strategy. So if we take a look of the history of the CCP, right, China Communist Party, either you agree with their political ideology or not, but it's kind of amazing that they formed the party around like 1921, and then only 20 plus years later, and then they become the ruling party, right? So Mao Zedong's military and political strategy led to his victory against the Japanese invasion, against the much better equipped Chinese nationalist forces in the Civil War in the late 1940s, right? And again, actually, it's kind of achieving stalemate agreements, American forces in Korea in 1950s. So if we take a look at the history, and it's perhaps not surprising that some entrepreneurs, that they kind of half serious said that the Communist Party of China, it's a great startup success, right? So many entrepreneurs try to draw the inspiration from Mao and viewing his strategy as a startup playbook. So I just give you a very quick example,
okay,
right? So
yes,
one of the Mao's wisdom in earlier days is in Chinese is called 农村包围城市. So which means like in English is seize the countryside to encircle the city. So Mao's idea is like China is still a largely farming society, and the real power is in the countryside. It's in those farmers, right? So to succeed in the revolution, the communists must abandon their worker-focused doctrine, which is originated from Soviet Union, to set up the basis in the countryside. When the communists accumulate enough power through their countryside and mountain bases, then their attack on the cities were both swift and decisive, right? And now if we create a metaphor analogy of the CCP's strategy in those earlier days with some of the Chinese tech strategy like Alibaba, right? Actually, you can see some similarities. So when Alibaba built this like e-commerce empire, actually, they tried to address the masses, the C2C market, or create this Taobao, and focusing on the low price products and individual sellers, and then gradually move to the high quality products launch they call Tmall, right? Tmall in China. So this is one of the strategy that they use actually learn from this like CCP's like early startup days. And this mindset is kind of different from those Silicon Valley firms, right? So Silicon Valley firms, they tend to start with the high-end market and then goes to the mass market. For instance, when Uber launched the ad sharing, all right, they focus the Uber Black, right? That is the luxury car. And if you think about the Tesla's first model, when they launched the model, actually the sports car, it's the target luxury high-end market. Once they conquer that high-end market, they move to the mass market. But Chinese company, they take the design, 农村包围城市, right? It's a good thing to the mass. occupy the village, occupy the mountain base, and then they target the city or the high-end market. So this is one of the examples which we think it's very interesting and we discuss in our book.
It's so fascinating because you think Chinese tech and you think cutting edge, you think so modern. And in fact, a lot of these leaders were looking to the past political strategies, which seem to have worked out for them. I mean, how do some of these past political strategies, for example, explain their approach to hyper-competitiveness in the tech space and what they do to stay ahead of competition?
Yeah, so we have some discussion in the book and eventually, right? So how does the company keep the competitiveness and how to, you know, always keep ahead of the competition? This is one of the fundamental issues that all the tech leaders, they're thinking partially because of the industry, because the environment is much more dynamic. So what we observe, right, on the surface level, it's always the product, right? So how do they quickly update the products and try to make the products to customize to the consumers, right? So this is the surface level. But fundamentally, how to keep the company to be very competitive, it's the deep level things, which is in the pop leadership, we call this it's not only the product, but also more important, it's about the organization, it's about the people, and also about the leadership mindsets. So in the book, we discuss some of the, very typical tactics that they use, in the organization, for instance, Chinese tech companies, they tend to have a lot of small restructuring, and then they keep changing the reporting lines. Literally, they just try to inject certain organizational change in a very frequent way to motivate the people to make it more agile, because once the company become bigger, then they tend to be more bureaucratic, right? So changing the organizational structure in a more frequent way, this is the one way that the Chinese tech companies that they use to try to keep the organizational agile and keep the competitiveness. And they also use lots of the executive rotation, right? So which is kind of aligned with the organizational change, right? The position change, the executive rotations. And then they try to create internal competition teams, which make the market within the firm, it's highly competitive. So they do not only compete with the external party, they also compete within the firm, which means that the other teams that perhaps they are going to co-develop or simultaneously have certain job tasks. So create this internal competition. So all this kind of the organization and the people and the leadership mindsets, that is the fundamental drive, try to push the quick updates of the products, right? And then to try to keep their firms to be competitive in this very volatile environment.
It's a terrific book, over 300 hours of interviews. If you've just joined us, this is Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin, talking with Professor Guo Lichen, who is the author of the book Seeing the Unseen. And we are discussing what exactly makes Chinese tech leaders different from Silicon Valley's and what explains their phenomenal success. So we talked about staying agile, competition within the organization, sort of injecting change. So these Chinese tech organizations are almost competing with themselves first. I wonder, even as they scale up, what are they doing to stay ahead of the crowd? What are they realizing about the limitations of this approach to leadership, which you have termed the pop leadership?
Yeah, so keep the big organizational agile, like I said earlier, it's always one of the critical questions, right? And when they become big, I think one of the very normal paths is they step out of the domestic market, right, and try to become a global players, like the example that you mentioned earlier, like the TikTok and the other companies like Alibaba or Tencent, right? So if you think the challenge of the scaling up, one, of course, it's within the domestic market. Like I said earlier, they try to inject change in the organization. They try to have some human or HR policies, if a little bit kind of the forced retirements in the relative young age in those tech companies. And the other challenge is actually when they go into the global market, this is part of the scaling up process, right? And then when they get into the global market and then the Chinese companies, and then some of the practice that they use in this like pop leadership, perhaps it doesn't fit extremely well with a different market, right? So I'll give you some example. For instance, Chinese companies' culture may not be appreciated by the overseas employees. So like, for instance, one of the interviewees said that, I mean, on average, that they like the culture of the American company more. They don't like the TikTok because, you know, the company culture is just like much like an army, like the military services. And which can create some of the challenge in terms of the people proposition, right? So relatively, it's hard to hire or motivate the local talents. And on average, perhaps that the smaller talent pools that these like Chinese company that they can leverage in overseas markets compared with some of the American company like Amazon. So, I mean, that is the issues that they are going to face, not only in the domestic market, but also in the international market.
I guess a lot of our listeners are investors in Chinese tech firms. And when there was sort of a chilling of the environment, we saw, you know, China's state coming down hard on the tech firms. There were a lot of questions as to their viable future. What do you see as the what's next for Chinese companies in terms of the global business landscape?
I mean, this is a big debate, right? And what's the next step, right? I mean, on the one hand, if you think about consumer tech, right, China's still big market with billions of consumers, which means that they still have the opportunities. And then this large ecosystem within China can motivate lots of like business model innovations, including like recently, which is pretty phenomenal in China, is the live stream e-commerce, right? So they create a new business model and how to use live, how to combine live stream with the e-commerce together to achieve the higher and active sales and much more engaged selling process. So the domestic market is still very important for these like Chinese tech companies, especially for those like e-commerce and consumer tech, right? But on the other hand, I think that the global market is something that's must do, right? So in those earlier days, some of my friends or interviewees said that like global markets could be just, you know, the dessert, but the main dish is still like in the domestic market. But nowadays, with some of the environmental change or the policy change in China, then globalization or step out of China could become the main dishes for these companies in the future. But of course, when they step out of China, they are going to face a very different environment, consumers, policies. So there's still a learning process for these like Chinese tech companies.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of policies, when you step into the main dish, what happens when the main dish bites back? You know, I'm talking about the US and delisting Chinese tech firms and all discussion in that area. What do you think the possible delisting of Chinese BMOs from US stock markets mean for the future of Chinese tech firms?
First, I think it's still not a done deal, right? So, I mean, that's true. There's some geopolitical issues and certain frictions between two giant countries, China versus the US. Personally, I hoped they are still some negotiation process. So far, it doesn't mean that the US stock market are going to totally delist or ban those Chinese companies to list it in the US. I think it's still in a negotiation process of being part of this like geopolitical conflicts. But if one day, assuming that the US market or capital markets is totally shut down to these like Chinese tech firms, I think the major challenge is, of course, for those like tech entrepreneurs, where can they get the source of the fundings? And even if the business model is doing well, and then how can those investors can have a proper access strategy? I mean, personally, I hope it's not going to happen. But if one day it really happens in that way, And then the impact actually could be multiple facets, right? It's not only about the consumer market, but also the capital market. And also the other implications is not only in the business, but in many other domains. And personally, I hope that's not going to happen, because there's always a certain negotiation base between China and the US, because economically, actually, they're highly weaved with each other. The global supply chain and the efficiency focus in the business world are going to help to address some of the political issues.
Let me bring this back to an area that I personally find interesting, Professor. I know that your strategy looks at the influence of CEOs on firm strategic decisions. And I'm going to be teaching a class soon on influence. And I wonder what you can share from your research into how Chinese tech leaders approach this whole sphere of being able to influence on a one-on-one or a one-to-many basis.
Chinese tech leaders, many of them, they learn from like the Chinese culture, right? So you can see that the different leadership styles, and like give you one example, right? In the Western society, they tend to separate the working life versus the personal life. And in China, actually, many companies, they have a lot of activities during the off the office hour, right? Maybe like during the weekend, have the team building. And in most of the Western company, perhaps they will think this is, you know, it's kind of violation of the personal time. But in China, actually, lots of team buildings and the relationships building, and also the influence from the department manager to their lower level employees, or between the CEOs and the senior executive teams. And lots of team building actually could happen in the off the office hours, right? So you can see this is like one of the very unique contact, which is highly embedded in Asian culture. And it works well in China, but once you step into China, like if they have subsidiaries in US or maybe in Italy or Poland, and such practice actually, such a practice of the leadership influence perhaps may backfire, right? So fundamentally, we need to understand what's the context, what's the different types of leaderships, and how can we fit the leadership style with the specific context to make it more effective in terms of the influencing.
Fascinating, because I was just speaking with a US business leader who said he would never mix business with social on the golf course, for example. He would never pitch an investment idea. And there's clear separation of business and social. And you saying that those two are quite intermingled when it comes to Chinese tech leadership. Fascinating. More insights. If you'd like more, pick up his book. I've been speaking with Professor Guo Lichen. He's the author of Seeing the Unseen. This is Money and Me. If you'd like to understand more about Chinese tech giants and are they taking over the world, their leadership styles as well, this is the book to pick up. Guo Li, thank you so much for being with us today here on Money FM 89.3. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.